Welcome back to the Power Hour. So glad that you have remained or joined us. Pollack, Dr. Gerald Pollack is now here. He is a professor at the University of Washington there in Seattle. Have you ever been to Seattle? There's no city I've ever been quite like it. It's beautiful. And it's surrounded by what we're going to talk about today, water. So maybe that's where he got his inspiration. I don't know. He's written several books. His new one, The Fourth Phase of Water, is one of the most popular scientific books on Amazon right now. The Fourth Phase of Water. He's a Brand Laureate Award winner for achievement. Other recipients like Steve Jobs has, Nelson Mandela has received this award. And now our next guest, Dr. Gerald Pollack. Gerald, welcome to the Power Hour.
Thank you, Daniel. I'm really happy to be here with you, and thanks for the nice introduction. Appreciate that.
Yes. Yes, of course. The pleasure's ours, for sure. Tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got fascinated with water. Where did this come from?
It came from, earlier in my career, our interests were directed toward understanding how muscles contract at the molecular level. We tried to figure it out. The prevailing view in the scientific literature is one that simply didn't fit the evidence, and so we were trying to figure out how it really does work. And it occurred to me that what's missing from all of those considerations is the main ingredient inside our muscle cells, and that's water. You know, scientists have been trying to figure out the mechanism of contraction for many years, half a century easily, and they consider the proteins inside the muscle, the protein folding and such that might cause the contraction, but nobody pays attention, or almost nobody, to the water. So, you know, two-thirds of every one of your muscle cells, two-thirds by volume, is water. And if you count the number of molecules of water, if you line up all the molecules in your cell, any cell, muscle cell, other cell, and you start counting them, you find that 99, more than 99 out of 100 are water molecules. And that's because those water molecules are really small. And in order to fit them to make up that two-thirds volume that water contains, you need a lot of water molecules. So it came as a kind of surprise to me that 99% of the molecules are considered by scientists to be virtually useless, or even more than that, ignored as though the molecules weren't there. You see, so this struck me as odd, and at the same time, I met an influential scientist who was dealing with water, and his name is Gilbert Ling. He's now 99 years old and still kicking. And the major theme of his work, that even by that time was written in, I think, five or six different books when I met him, and that was that the water molecules inside the cell, including muscle cells, any cells, that the molecules are lined up. Organized, you know, sort of like dominoes or Legos, if you will, and that idea was contradictory, or I guess you might say, is still contradictory to what all scientists think or thought, and that is that the molecules are just like water molecules in a glass of water that you drink, that the molecules are randomly bouncing around a huge number of times each second. And this is totally different because Gilbert Ling was saying that the molecules of water inside the cell were organized like soldiers standing at attention. See, so completely different concept. And at first, I wasn't sure of this, although his ideas seemed so interesting and so appealing. And I gave one of his books to some of my students and postdocs, and every one of them came back and said, you know, this guy is really on to something important. And I thought so, too. I just wanted to get support, confirmation from some of my students. And so that was my first, you might say, incursion into studying water. And what I tried to do in that is to, at first, I thought Gilbert Ling's ideas were so powerful. I wanted to bring them in an understandable way to the public, even scientists, because when Gilbert writes a book, Gilbert can understand it, but not too many other people. It's a challenge to read. It may be okay for physical chemists and such, but for the rest of us and the world, it's challenging. So I tried to simplify the message, and that was the objective of my 2001 book, which is called Cells, Gels, and the Engines of Life. I think I did a reasonable job. The book was controversial. Some loved it and some hated it. I had come to the conclusion in that not only was the water pretty much as Gilbert was talking about, that is, ordered in some way, but that the transition between the ordered water and ordinary water is a trigger for so many basic fundamental biological events, things that occur in our body all the time. And so that's how it started. And of course, being a curious kind of guy, I wanted to do experiments to find out more about this seemingly peculiar kind of water. And we happened on an experimental methodology that we actually it started with a Japanese scientist, and he was telling me about some results, and I knew instantly that the kind of experiment that he was doing for another purpose was just right for us, and I had the second good fortune. Go ahead.
Allow me to interject for a second here. I mean, you said a lot of things. Very interesting how, just listening to a scientist, a professor, how they go through this process of discovery. It's, you know, for the lay people, that's interesting. A couple questions came to mind. One, you said people were applauded your book and people had disdain for your book. Why do people have disdain for this idea? Is it because it's new? Is it because it hurts their other theories? Why do they repel this new idea you're bringing?
I think you put your finger on it. This was early. This was, you know, 15 years ago with my first book on water, not the most recent one. But it's simply that that scientists, like other human beings, want to feel secure. And what does secure mean? Well, secure means having a laboratory that is well-funded. So you can't do anything without money. So if I'm the kingpin in my field, I can easily get money from either the National Science Foundation or the National Institutes of Health, depending on what I'm doing. But if what I'm proposing challenges the general prevailing belief system, then I have a big challenge up ahead, because the people who are going to review my application for money are the experts in the field. So if you, example, consider the shape of the earth, so everybody knows the earth is flat. You can just look out there and it looks flat, right? And imagine some people being the experts on the shape of the flat earth, the bumps here and there and the little mountains and lakes and whatever, but it's flat. And suppose I come to the organization and say, hey, you know, I need some money to study something. I think the earth is round, and I even have some preliminary evidence. You know, I've been looking at satellite photos, and maybe my eyes are not perfect, but it looks to me like they're spherical. You know, the earth is spherical seen from a distance. And also, I left Seattle. I took a flight, and I went west, and I wound up in Beijing, and from there to Moscow, and from there to Washington, D.C., and back to Seattle. And I got back, you know, and if the earth is flat, I'm not sure how that happened. So it looks like I've got some real evidence. Could you give me more money? Because this is a very important topic, and I should study it further to see if the round earth is the true shape and not the flat earth. So the gatekeeper at one of the organizations says, oh, this looks very important, and I better get the experts in the field to make judgment as to whether this is lunacy or this has some promise. And so who do they hire? They hire the experts in the flat earth, right, because these are the experts in the field. And you can imagine their reaction to someone who they're the kingpins in the field of flat earth, the little bumps, and someone comes and says, you know, you're all wet. It's not flat at all. It's round. So this is disquieting and insecure for the people who are the dominant people. And I'm not suggesting that these people are evil or anything. We're all in search of truth. But the person who challenges, you know, it's like the French revolutionaries challenging Louis XVI. They come and say, hey, you know, we don't exactly like what's going on. And how do you think the revolutionaries will be received by the king? It's analogous. So I think this is a reason why some people are protective, unduly protective of their respective turfs.
Of their position. You bring up an even broader, maybe more important question. How influential is the money that is given for these experiments that you see? How influential is the source of the money to the actual results of the experiments?
It's mixed. It shouldn't have any influence, obviously, and I think in some cases it probably doesn't, but in many cases it does. And so you can imagine, suppose you're, for example, studying a drug, the effect of a drug on health. There are many, many clinical trials going on. And you're asked to do some research on this drug. Now, if your money comes from the drug company, it's pretty clear that there's going to be some implicit bias, which we all try to restrain ourselves from following that. The drug company would like a positive result, and so if there's some equivocation on how I might interpret the results, I might lean slightly toward what the drug company likes, because I know that I'm going to be getting more money from the drug company in the future to pursue my research, and this will help yeah. fund my laboratory. See, it almost has to. Another example is the effect of cell phones, for example, and electromagnetic pollution in the environment. So my colleague, who just retired from down the hall, was studying this sort of thing, and he tells me, and he tells his students too, that when the money for the effects of cell phones is given by a cell phone company, 95% of the reports indicate that there's no health issue at all. And when the money comes from some independent source, like a foundation or private money or whatever, 95% of the reports show that there is a problem. So yes, I think this is a
conflict of interest there. Hey, hold that thought, Doc. We'll be right back. We're talking to Dr. Gerald Pollack from the University of Washington, professor there, who has written a book called, well, it's many books, but his newest one, The Fourth Phase of Water, and has done some groundbreaking research and pushed these ideas and concepts of what water is. We, you know, 25 years ago, 30 years ago, we didn't really know in the public mind, in our consciousness, what water is. The scientific community now, in large part to Dr. Pollack, are understanding different ideas about water and its essential nature and just what it does. Dr. Pollack, one of the things you said I want to ask you about here in this short segment, you mentioned that water becomes ordered. It's in line, like waiting like a soldier to go or to do or to be commanded. What is it that orders it? What is it that structures this water?
Well, it was to our great surprise, because we knew that it was structured, but we couldn't figure out, you know, in order to structure something, you need energy to put in to order something that's disordered. It's a fundamental attribute of physics and chemistry. And to our surprise, we found that it was light coming in from outside. In other words, light from the sun, light from the sky, light from an artificial lamp. You put the light in, and the EZ or the fourth phase, we call it EZ or exclusion zone, because this zone being ordered has a tendency to exclude stuff, just the same way that ice has a tendency to exclude debris to be pure. So, and the energy to do this comes from light. We studied different wavelengths of light. You know, the light comes between ultraviolet, and then there's visible light extending from the violet all the way to the long wavelengths of red. and then beyond to infrared. And it's infrared that we found is most powerful for structuring or organizing the water.
Now, water is one of the few things that, it may be the only thing, I don't know, you comment on this, that it actually expands when it freezes. Is that correct?
Yep.
Where did that come from?
Okay. Yeah, so...
Well, I know that the oceans would be one, you know, everything in the ocean would die in Antarctica if it wasn't true, but go ahead, explain it to me.
The fish would be gasping for water when the pond freezes over. But if it starts from the bottom to the top. The reason for this is what we found experimentally, and this is in the book that you, the fourth phase book that you mentioned, is that if you want to freeze water, you know, we all know water has three phases, has a vapor or gas, and then a liquid, and then a solid. So if you want to go from the liquid to the solid, from water to ice, the thought is, well, obviously, you just reduce the temperature and you freeze it. But we found that it's not quite like that. What you need to do is to go from water to fourth phase water, this phase that we discovered that where it's organized, not exactly the way I mentioned Gilbert Ling suggested, but another way. But anyway, that's secondary. But the point is, in order to go from ice to water, you must go through this easy fourth phase stage before you freeze. This is essential. Now, when you start cooling the water, and as you cool the water, this fourth phase builds, and it then transitions at some point, that's freezing, to ice. But the transition from the two, it means that you're transitioning from one stage to another stage, and this fourth phase stage is very compact. It's really dense. So when you go from the fourth phase into ice is highly expanded. It has a structure that's not so different from this fourth phase, but it's less dense. And it's less dense because it's got protons sitting between sheets, between layers. The protons get inserted there, take up space, and that's what creates ice from easy water. And so that's the reason people have a hard time understanding because most solids most liquids as they solidify, they contract. But water is not the same. As it solidifies, it expands. And the reason, I think, has to do with our findings that freezing really goes from easy water, which is compact, to ice, which is less compact. Is that okay?
Basically,
you lost me a little bit.
We're coming on a break. Let's get into fourth. What is the fourth phase? Because I'm not a scientist, and our audience, you know, most of them are not scientists. So let's kind of break down fourth phase a little bit. Very fascinating, water. And why is this information even important? Why do we need to know this? What have we learned from this about water? Stay tuned, ladies and gentlemen. The fourth phase of water, excuse me, Dr. Gerald Pollack. 2-9. The fourth phase of water is the book written by Dr. Gerald Pollack. He's a Brand Laureate Award winner. They're out of Seattle area, and he knows more about water than he's forgotten more about water than you'll ever know. Let's put it that way. Let's switch gears a little bit, Dr. Pollack. I can remember I was fascinated by the study or writings or whatever. I'm not even sure what it was, but there was a Japanese scientist who was studying water, and one set of water he was playing good music, saying nice things to it. The other, he was, you know, playing disruptive music or yelling at it. I really can't even remember the different variations. And then he froze the water, and the crystalline structures under magnification were completely different. It was really fascinating. I believe his name was Emoto. Will you go into that a little bit?
Sure. That was Masaru Emoto, who passed about 3 or 4 years ago. And his work, by the way, is taken over by his son and his widow, and also some other people who I've gotten to know pretty well. And they're mostly, they're not scientists in general. They're spiritualists, and but their work has some scientific implications. So you can imagine that most people would scoff at the idea that you can think positive thoughts or play some music that is pleasing music versus saying evil thoughts and music that is hard to listen to for most people. And he demonstrated that the crystals, when the positive thoughts like love and attention and gratitude, they get beautiful crystals, and the horrible music, which some people love, I guess, and negative thoughts produce ugly crystals. The book, the results became really popular, and the several books that Emoto produced demonstrating that produced an enormous amount of interest throughout. So I got interested in this because I was pointing out before that when you create ice, you must go through an intermediate step of easy water. So you start with ordinary water, you cool it, and it turns into easy water, or fourth phase water. That's the organized version that Gilbert Ling was talking about. And then ice, you see. And in this stage of organized water, the fourth phase stage where molecules are ordered in some way, this can receive information. We don't think of water exactly as receiving information, although someone proposed this about 20 years ago and lost his career, a French scientist, Jacques Benveniste, because everybody thought he must be nuts. But you see, now once we discover this crystalline form of water, that's it's not a solid, it's not a liquid, it's in between, this fourth phase of water, because it has a regular crystalline structure, just like a computer memory has. You know, it's got silicon atoms that are arrayed in three dimensions in regular places, and each silicon atom could have two states corresponding to a zero and a one. Similar, the water, the oxygen atoms can have actually five different states, not just two, and each one can be in theory addressed separately. So there is a capacity for this fourth phase of water to have information, and so if you are doing what Emoto did and putting some kind of energy into the water, if the water has fourth phase water in it, it's going to capture the information, and when it freezes, that information will be reflected in the frozen water, that is, in the ice. So I visited their offices in Tokyo, and I spent 2 days giving lectures there, which were, you know, warmly received. And the main point that I tried to bring out is that there is a scientific basis for what they found. So that's why Emoto and his work and our approach are, in a sense, complementary. We have scientific evidence, and they have what you might call spiritual evidence, and the two of them may actually intersect in the photos that he produced of the beautiful photos of frozen crystals. Is that helpful?
Have they been duplicated? Yeah, have other people duplicated these experiments, for lack of a better word, that they've done? Have they duplicated them?
I don't know if anybody has. I mean, yes, people are duplicating it all the time. There's a Japanese woman, and her name is Akiko Stein, and she works in Germany, and she takes waters from various people and freezes them in the same way that Emoto did, to test their waters to see if the waters have a positive spirit and such, and she does this all the time on a daily basis. When I visited Japan, I was witness to demonstrate how they do it, and I was there right in the closet-like laboratory where they do it, and I could see these crystals being formed. So I think the answer is yes, although, you know, because it's spiritual and not scientific, you won't see publications in standard scientific journals. So in that sense, you might say it's not been duplicated, but in fact it has.
Well, you mentioned the scientist who lost his career for basically, what was he claiming? He's saying that water can, that your words can have power on water, that water can receive outside information. I mean, what was he saying that he got so blackballed for?
Well, he got blackballed because he's a famous immunologist, and his stuff appeared in textbooks and such. His name was Jacques Benveniste from Paris, and he was doing experiments on a certain kind of white blood cell called a basophil, and he would pour some antibodies on these cells, and they would spew out or they would secrete a chemical called histamine. And he was basically working on these experiments. And one day someone came to him and said to him, you know, I can do the same experiment you're doing, but instead of pouring the antibodies, I can pour highly, highly diluted antibodies and get the same result. He said, I can even dilute it to the point where there are no antibodies left, only water, and get the same result. And Jacques, whom I knew, said, this is crazy. Yeah, it can't be. It doesn't make any sense. He said, but he was an open-minded scientist, and he said, you know, I got this big laboratory of 50 people. Go work in the corner here and demonstrate what you can do. Well, pretty soon everybody in the laboratory was hovering over this guy's shoulder to demonstrate that it was true, that you can go through dilution after dilution. And this is the same way that homeopaths prepare their preparations. They take a substance and they dilute it, say, 1 to 10, and they shake it. And then they dilute that 1 to 10, and they shake it, and so on. They keep doing this. And, of course, when you dilute it, pretty soon there's nothing left if you do it enough times except water. And so this was kind of weird, and he noticed that the experiments were working.
Hold that thought, Dr. Pollack. Hold that thought right there. This is fascinating. This is really important, I think, what you're mentioning. We'll be back after this break. One more segment with you. Wow. The book is The Fourth Phase of Water, Dr. Gerald Pollack. It's one of the most popular scientific books on Amazon, and you can see why. I mean, there's so much to water. Imagine. Welcome back to the Power Hour. Hearing this, it reminds me of Willard water. You know, it's like they don't even know. They're not sure what it does, but it does something. Maybe we could send some up to Doc, some Willard water, to Dr. Pollack. Let him study that. And the prill beads, that helps the water also. So check out that at the Power Mall. Before the break, you talked about basically homeopathics being proven by this Frenchman who was amazed by it and his career was ruined over it. Finish that story, if you would.
Yeah, so he tried to submit his findings to the most prominent journal, that's Nature. And the editor wrote back, and all of this is in various books, and that's the story I'm telling, wrote back and says, you know, it's impossible. If you're right, then everybody else is wrong, because it simply can't be. And naturally, he was ticked off by that, and so he thought, well, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to ask colleagues around the world to repeat the experiment, and we'll try to publish it together. They tried. Same response. And pretty soon, the homeopaths in Paris, of which there are many, were getting angry because this scientific hero, this Frenchman, was demonstrating that what they do in homeopathy was something that is real. And this guy was demonstrating it. So Nature, headquartered in London across the channel, was feeling the pressure intensely. So Jacques told me he got a call from the editor of Nature, Sir John Maddox, and he said, Maddox said, okay, I'll publish your paper on one condition. What's the condition? Well, we're going to send a committee of peers your way to kind of look over your shoulder and see what you're doing, and we'll report back to our readers a month after publication. So he agreed to it because he knew he had something. So they came, and the committee that came was not exactly a committee of peers. It consisted of the editor himself, who was not exactly fair-minded, because he didn't want to publish it. He was sort of pushed. And he hired two people. One of them was the amazing Randy, who was considered the world's greatest magician.
A magician.
And because he could figure out everybody's tricks. You know, he's very good at that and still does that. And then there was another guy, Walter Stewart, who was in the Center for Scientific Integrity at the National Institutes of Health. So the committee assembled, and they had the technician who does the experiment repeat the experiment in front of him. He did that two times in a row, and they got the same result that they reported, even though they reported that it doesn't happen every time, but most of the time, easily statistically significant. So then the third time, this guy, Walter Stewart, did the dilutions himself, and he didn't get that result. And so they went back to their hotel, and they huddled, and they said, well, it looks like when the French people do the experiment, it works, and when we, the committee, do the experiment one time, it doesn't work, therefore it must be a hoax, it must be a trick. And next week in Nature, water memory is a delusion appeared. And after that, his career went downhill. He couldn't get any more funding. His lab went from 50 to zero very quickly. And despite that, other people have now repeated his experiments and gotten a similar result. And at our annual water conference,
does that Dr. Pollack, you know, being a scientist, just quick answer, don't go into it long, but does that bother you as a scientist to see that basically a hatchet job they did on him?
Yeah, the thing is, it's not just him. It's virtually every. Think of Galileo. Think of Semmelweis. I don't know if you know about him in Hungary, 150 years ago, roughly, a young, bright Hungarian scientist came and noticed that the women who were going to the hospital were dying, and there was during childbirth, and he found out that the reason they're dying is that the doctors did an autopsy the first thing in the morning of the women who had died the night before, and then they did an internal exam on these women without washing their hands. They didn't know anything. And he discovered that washing your hands will improve the outcome. And his colleagues had got so outraged that they fired him. And he wound up in a mental institution. Yeah.
So oh, my gosh.
This is normal operating procedure for people who challenge the environment, who challenge hope.
What I've studied about consciousness and kind of scientific community and or the new science that's coming of consciousness and whatever, one thing that may have caused it to where the third scientist who did the experiment who didn't really want to work, one of the reasons why that didn't work for them, or maybe that didn't work, and this may blow your mind, is it didn't work because they didn't want it to work.
It doesn't blow my mind because I've heard it enough times that I have come to realize, you know, starting as a standard nut and bolt kind of materialist scientist, I've changed somewhat because I've seen enough evidence that consciousness is playing a big part in what's going on. Now, 150 years ago is when everybody began believing that everything can be understood by science, and I was in that category myself, and I still am sort of, but the cracks are opening a little bit for me because I've now seen enough evidence, not speculation, but evidence that these sorts of things can have a major effect.
Well,
so, yes.
Let me cut you off. I know you wanted to mention something about water and our health, and you want to take the last part. We're running out of time. We only got a couple minutes. I'm sorry. I apologize. Just quickly, water and our health.
We're built of water, mostly, two-thirds water, 99% of our molecules are water. We need that water for function of the cell. The cell is filled with fourth-phase water. in order to be healthy, our cell needs to remain filled with fourth phase water. Many of the therapies that come from China, from Ayurvedic times and whatever, various herbs, we've studied a whole bunch of them. They all build easy water, or fourth phase water. And we think that's the reason why those agents, curcumin, for example, is one of them. Ghee is another. We found experimentally they build fourth phase water, and we think this is the reason why they are good for health. Also, sauna. Go into a sauna. It's hot, full of infrared energy. Builds easy water, fourth phase water in our body. Replenishes what's missing. And I could go on from there, but I think we're almost out of time. So another time.
Well, fascinating. Yeah. We're going to have you on again. Well, I'll get a copy of your book next time so I can be a little more prepared. I didn't know you were coming on today.
I think you enjoyed it.
It's an absolute pleasure meeting you.
Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you.
I hope that you had a good time.
Yeah.
Yes, Dr. Pollack, I hope you had a good time. We certainly did.
Great fun. Thank you so much, Daniel. Okay, take care. We'll see you.
Yeah, you're very welcome. We'll do it again. Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Pollack, there he goes. At the Power Mall, I mean, this. I'm going to, right after this, I get off.